This is Polyphonic Press, the podcast where two music fans pick a classic album completely at random. Using the patented random album generator, they are given an album to review from a curated list of over 1,000 classic releases, spanning multiple genres. And now onto the show. Here are your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. We've got the patented random album generator right in front of us here. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. And the album we're going to be listening to is Elliott Smith, Either Or. Okay. I know the name Elliott Smith, but I don't know much about his music.
Yeah, I've heard the name too. I couldn't name a song though.
But anyway, this is what it says on allmusic.com. It says that Elliott Smith's third album sees his one-man show getting a little more ambitious. While he still plays all the instruments himself, he plays more of them. Several of the songs mimic the melody mastery of pop bands from the 60s. The most alluring numbers, however, are still his quietly melancholy acoustic ones. While the full band songs are catchy and smart, Smith's recording equipment isn't quite up to the standards set by the Beatles and the Beach Boys. The humbler arrangements are better suited to the sparse equipment. Between the Bars, for example, plays Smith's strengths perfectly. He sings in his endearingly limited whisper of late-night drinking and introspection, and his subdued strumming creates a minor-key mood befitting the mysterious of self. Angeles is equally ethereal. Smith's acoustic finger-picking spins out notes which briskly move around a single atmospheric keyboard chord like oral minnows swimming toward a solitary light at the surface of the water. The lyrics are darkly biting. The lyrics are a darkly biting rejection of hyper-capitalist dream machinery of Los Angeles. It would make a great theme song for Smith's label, Kill Rock Stars. Ironically, Angeles was included on the Good Will Hunting soundtrack, which won Smith the acclaim of Hollywood's biggest, brightest, and best-connected voting body, the Academy Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Smith's stock in L.A. soared after he took his bow at the Oscars with Celine Dion and Trisha Yearwood. It might have been more interesting had he sung Angeles. Okay. So this album was released on February 25th, 1997. The genres are indie folk, indie rock, lo-fi, and Americana. The label is Kill Rock Stars and produced by Elliott Smith, Tom Rothrock, and Rob Schnapp. And there are 12 songs on the album, and because it's released in the 90s, it was the primary format was CD, so there's really no side one or side two. So I guess what we'll do is we'll stop at the halfway point, which is after song six. So the album starts with Speed Trials, and the first half ends with No Name number 5. So if you're listening along, which we encourage you to do, and we've linked the album in the show notes so you can get it on your preferred streaming service. You can stop halfway through at the after song number 6, and we'll discuss at the halfway point. And without further ado, there it is. Okay, so here is the first song on the album, and it's called Speed Trials. Here we go. Okay, and ending the first half of the album with No Name number 5. Yeah, this is really interesting. It's not my usual kind of music that I listen to, but I'm finding myself like really kind of getting into it. It's just sort of kind of it is melancholy, but it's also kind of relaxing at the same time.
Yeah, I think this is definitely quality, but He's doing stuff that's sort of similar to like, well, he really reminds me of like Sloan on their second album.
Yeah, second and third album.
Second and third, I guess the third album, yeah, too. The yeah. third album, they picked up the, they got a little bit rockier on the third album.
A little bit.
A lot of places, but in a lot of places, yeah, actually, they stayed.
Yeah, songs like Autobiography, and it kind of really reminds me of this, you know.
Yeah, but the recording quality, and they did talk about this. It seems to be a little bit. His voice could be up in the mix, because his voice is very soft. It's a little too soft, but I don't know. It reminds me of like Sloan demos and stuff like that.
Yeah, it does. It definitely does have a demo feel to it, and I think. That's because that's pretty much what this is. I mean, he's recorded all of this pretty much at home. I think he spent some time in a studio. But yeah, it's pretty much all recorded. It's all him with all playing all the instruments and overdubbing everything. So it definitely does have that feel, and I would guess that he didn't make any demos. It's just he wrote the songs, and then these are the recordings.
Could be. Yeah, I mean, it's good stuff. I mean, the songwriting quality is really, really high, especially on, like the Ballad of Big Nothing. That was really good. Pictures of Me was really good, too.
Pictures of Me. That last song, No Name Number 5, I really like that as well. Yeah, I mean, so far there isn't a song that I haven't liked. I mean, it's one of those things that it's I don't know how to describe it. It feels very intimate, I guess.
Yeah, he also sort of reminds me of like Sean Lennon stuff. Especially his earlier stuff. But yeah, it's just that he's got that sort of Beatlesque melody writing style in a few songs. Actually, in quite a few songs. But definitely a little bit more modern take on it.
Yeah, I'm thinking like, yeah, a lot of the more acoustic stuff from like the White Album is coming up on here, like, but also, you know, some other stuff from the Beatles too.
Well, I would say that he's obviously using more modern equipment than what was used in the 60s. You can sort of hear that. Things are a little bit clearer, but not everything's balanced quite as much as I would have done it.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, that is true. That is the one criticism that I would have, is that it could be mixed better. I think I honestly don't know how it was recorded. I would assume that it's recorded. With maybe a computer, but maybe at least 2-inch tape. But if it's recorded with cassettes, that's really hard to mix on cassette.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a 4-track cassette recorder myself. And yeah, the things you would have to do to sort of get everything mixed and balanced, you just kind of have to try, and you know, if you don't get it right, you kind of have to try again.
yeah, exactly. So I'm assuming he's like, this is his third album, so I'm assuming that he's at least, you know, he's got some professional equipment at home that he's able to mix on, and I think. Well, Tom Rothrock is the producer on this album, and I believe he did produce a Sloan album, the one that they went with an outside producer, Action Packed.
Oh, that sounds completely different than this album.
Yeah, Tom Rothrock. Yeah. But he's produced quite a few people. He's produced, he's done James Blunt, Foo Fighters, Moby, Beck, R.L. Burnside, Athlete, Gwen Stefani, Motorhead, Stevie Nicks, Poison, Elliott Smith, Richard Thompson, Yonder Mountain String Band. Like, this guy's done a lot of albums.
Yeah, and crossing a lot of different genres. Like, with the first few you named off there, it's just like, okay, yeah, I can sort of see the genres the genre he's following, and then it just got names from all over the place, and I'm like, okay, he's not a one-trick pony. So, but yeah, this is obviously on the earlier side of some of the stuff he's done, I'm guessing.
I think so. I think, I think this is like where he started out, mostly. Yeah. Yeah. This is pretty much at the beginning of Tom Rothrock's career. So, you know, I do think maybe though they were going for that lo-fi sound.
And
perhaps the sort of mixing the vocals a little lower, it could be intentional.
It could be. You get the vibe, but you miss the lyrics. And I think he's one of those guys who the lyrics are kind of important. So, I don't know. There's ways to mix and give it a lo-fi thing. Like, perfect example I can think of right now is Kevin Parker, Tame Impala. The way he records stuff, he gets like incredible moods, but his vocals are clear, even if they've got like, you know, a lot of echo and other things on them, but you can understand what he's saying. So there are ways to do that, but I guess, I don't know, maybe technology limitations or equipment limitations or... So this was, again, was 1997, so there were, you know, computer programs and stuff like that to do stuff on. But
but I don't know if they're using that.
Yeah, I don't know if they're using that either. I'm thinking it's pretty low analog what they're doing, which again is also really cool. I know Tame Impala, a lot of the equipment he uses is pretty analog, but I think there's computers involved with the actual mixing and stuff like that.
So that's an interesting question. Like with Tame Impala, you know, being pretty popular now, do you think if this album were to be released like in that current sort of space, not necessarily the mainstream, but the space that Tame Impala occupies, do you think this would sort of do anything? Like, would this album have an impact?
It's hard to say. It's definitely a different sort of thing, whereas, like, Kevin Parker's stuff is pretty psychedelic. This isn't quite the psychedelic. It's a little bit more the, if I were to compare it to, like, Beatles albums, I would say it was more like Rubber Soul Revolver sort of stuff.
Yeah.
A little bit into the White Album. So it's kind of before and after the psychedelic era.
I sort of get that, more current. Maybe he's a little older now, but certainly 10, 15 years ago, he was doing a lot of stuff. It's a guy, I think he plays the piano.
It'll come to you.
Bon Iver.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. If you compare it to something like that, I think, actually, come to think of it, I think Elliott Smith's most of his stuff has become more popular in more recent years than I think it was at the time.
Well, it has. It was pretty critically acclaimed when it came out, but it did not sell at all. Like, he wasn't famous at all. So this is on Wikipedia. It says Either Or was critically acclaimed. Stephen Thompson of the AV Club wrote that the album marks something of a thematic transition for Smith, noting brightness and a pop feel on Either Or, in contrast to the stark guy with acoustic guitar confessionals about drug abuse and darkness on Elliott Smith. So that's like a retrospective review. It was voted the 20th best album of 1997 in the Village Voice, which is a New York arts newspaper, on the Paz and Jop critics poll. Poll's supervisor, Robert Crisco, was less enthusiastic about the album, finding Smith tuneful if depressing, and believing that he could be too popular. He just doesn't want to be, that's all. So, okay, so it didn't really gain the establishment critics all that much. But I think it hit a nerve with younger people. You know,
yeah, I think so. And again, his popularity has grown, although I still don't think he's like a household name. He's certainly more he comes up in conversations a lot more often than I think he did around the late 90s. So I think if he had released the album, you know, around the same time as Bon Iver was putting out stuff, I don't think it matters whether or not he recorded it in 97 or recorded it in 2007 or something, or 2017 or something like that. The fact that it's gaining more popularity around that time kind of shows that, yeah, that's kind of the time period it sort of belongs in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that is true. That is a good point. Yeah. So I did manage to find a few facts about the album. As we discussed, it was mostly recorded at home in Portland, Oregon, and which gives it that intimate feel. It was a favorite of director Gus Van Sant, who he directed Good Will Hunting, and he asked Elliott Smith to contribute a few songs from this album to the soundtrack to Good Will Hunting. So, and it's funny, in the initial review on AllMusic, it said that the song Angeles was a criticism of like the Hollywood sort of system and everything. But, you know, it's funny. I think, you know, Good Will Hunt, there was a time in the 90s when independent movies were really popular, and Good Will Hunting is part of that. So I don't think anybody really expected that movie to be as big of a hit as it was. So I think he may have been reluctant to, I think he was more than willing to give his songs to be included on the soundtrack, but sort of was not expecting the sort of rise in popularity. And I think that's what being on that soundtrack is sort of what drew more attention to him than this album itself.
Yeah, could be. And again, indie films have sort of, you know, they get a resurgence every once in a while. Like, I know about around the mid 2010s, they were all over Netflix.
Yeah. But, you know, I think the song Angeles, which is coming up, we haven't listened to it yet, but that is sort of the sort of big song that criticizes the scene, the sort of types of people that live in Los Angeles and that are, I don't know what the word is, but just sort of like the sort of superficial nature of Hollywood and sort of the whole city, not necessarily the artists or anything like that, but there's a lot, it attracts a lot of those kinds of people. On that happy note, I guess we'll get into the second side of the album. Yeah. So before we do that, let's hear from our friends over at the podcast, Getting Down and Wordy. So check that out.
Riz.
Greetings.
Gendered language.
Onomatopoeias.
The ick.
What makes some words sound funny?
Why just listen to music when you can overanalyze the words in the songs?
Music, language, and Eurovision all crammed into one podcast.
Getting down and wordy with Russell and Hannah. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
We'll now take a few seconds before we begin side two. Thank you. Here's side two.
Okay, and ending the album with Say Yes. Yeah, I really enjoyed this album. You know, it's not without its flaws, with, like you were saying, with the production and some of the mixing. His voice could be mixed a little louder, but I mean, overall, I think I really enjoyed this one.
Yeah, I think it's actually pretty good. Songwriting is really high quality for sure.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's what I like about this kind of stuff is, yeah, it's fun to write a really, you know, a great catchy song, but you know, sometimes you want to listen to something that's honest and that's, you know, as corny as it sounds, it comes from the heart. And, you know, it's good that he's doing it in a way that, you know, even though like this, the kind of production sort of lends itself to that, you know, and yes, his voice could be mixed a little better, but that's really a minor complaint overall. I think, you know, his songwriting is...
it's something you can get used to.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the first song, it was definitely a little too low. Through the rest of it, if you're listening close enough, you can make out stuff. It's still a little down in the mix, but it's not bad.
Yeah, I think this album overall is... It deserves its spot in, you know, the greatest albums of all time. I think, you know, like the last few weeks have been sort of going in this direction. I think this is sort of like John Martin before, and then the last week with the Waterboys. I think, you know, this sort of like more acoustic-y sort of confessional sort of type of songwriting. And I think this really, this album really fits into that. I mean, this is, there's really not a whole lot I can say negative about this album. Yeah. So, you know, it might be a difficult, task, but what would be your three highlights on the album? Your three favorite songs?
I'm going to go with Ballad of Big Nothing was really good. And then I think I'm going to do Alameda and maybe Cupid's Trick. I thought that song was really good. But there's a lot of other good ones on here too. Cupid's Trick was just like, that was the grunge song on the album.
Yeah, that was a great song as well. I think I would go with, I would go with Cupid's Trick, 2:45 a.m., and I think No Name Number 5. I mean, those would be my picks. That's really hard because there's a lot of, like, I don't think there's necessarily even a bad song on the album. I don't think there's a song that isn't worth listening to again or you know, repeating. So I guess, you know, that brings us to that question is, would you listen to this album again?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely would. Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those albums that I think, you know, the last few have been, well, I have to be in the mood to listen to this album. I honestly think I could probably put this on at any time and enjoy it. I think I could enjoy it for different reasons, depending on what mood I'm in. But I think whatever mood I'm in, I could, you know, I could put it on and enjoy it no matter what.
Yeah, I might still have to be in the right mood for it, but it's not hard. It's not that overly challenging of an album to get into. It's a very likable album in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. Yeah. It has its charm to it for sure. I guess we'll end the episode there. Thank you so much for listening. If you made it this far, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And we'd love it if you could leave a rating and a review on whatever listening app you're using to listen to this podcast. It really helps us find new listeners and helps get the word out. And if you want to support the show, you can do that by going to our Patreon. Go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress. And there you can get these episodes a day before they go live. So that's really cool. And you can even pick an album for us to review. And don't forget to check out polyphonicpress.com. You can get all the updates to what's going on, and also all the episodes that we've done so far. Lots of really great albums to discover there. And I think that just about does it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.